Just a heads up, everyone. This podcast features adults having adult conversations, and there might be the chance of adult language. Also, we may talk about some difficult grieving experiences and themes of mental distress that can trigger some people. If this conversation stirs up some hard emotions for you, please reach out to someone you trust. Hi. I'm Tatiana Rotere, and you are listening to Crazy Grief, the podcast. Grief can make us feel like we're going crazy. It affects our emotions, our physical health, and our mental state. It has a huge impact in the way we relate to people and the way we see ourselves. Crazy Grief is a safe space for us to have candid conversations about grief and all the crazy stuff that comes with it. We are here to share our stories, how we cope with grief, and what kind of help really helps. If you lost your person and you feel like you're going crazy, let me reassure you, you're not going crazy. You're just grieving. So, let's talk about it. Today is my absolute pleasure to have Dr. Ruth Lawson McConnell as a guest in Crazy Grief. Dr. Ruth is a sought-after counselor and trainer with 30 years' experience of counseling adults, children, adolescents, and families. She divides her time between counseling, parenting counseling, supervision, presenting professional development seminars, conference speaking, academic research, and writing, as well as adjunct teaching. Ruth specializes in attachment issues, both in adults and children. Her clinical practice involves individual work with people experiencing relationship difficulties, depression, anxiety, and trauma, specialist supervision on attachment issues, as well as parent consulting on behavioral and emotional issues in children and adolescents. She completed her MA honors in social anthropology and psychology at Aberdeen University, followed by a PhD in counseling psychology from Robert Gordon University in Aberdeen, Scotland. She's a professional associate of the Newfield Institute, where she trained with Dr. Gordon Newfield in his attachment-based developmental paradigm. She's also a certified neuropsychotherapist, as well as a partner of sexual addict trauma specialist. Ruth has authored several journal articles and conference papers, as well as presents professional development training for counselors. As the daughter of Scottish missionaries, Ruth grew up in the Amazon region of Brazil, and she speaks fluent Portuguese like me. She has two adult daughters, and she lives in Vancouver, Canada. She also has a beautiful dog named Panda, and she's a dear, dear friend. Hi, Ruth. It's so good to have you here.
Oh, Tatiana, it's my extreme delight. A new way to connect across all the miles.
Yes. I mean, you're so far away, and yet here we are. I can see your beautiful face, and it's just really awesome. Thank you so much for saying yes to coming on the show and to have this conversation with me. I'm looking forward so much to actually get into your brain and figure out a few things that I think would be really valuable. I know for me and for a lot of women that are in a similar situation as me. So, I wanted to ask you, first off, attachment-based counseling, what is that? Can you give us like a little bit, like in a nutshell, what is it?
Okay, let's try to put this in a nutshell, because for me, it's been years and years of trying to take the original training I had, which was psychodynamic counseling training, and then adding the layer of attachment into it that I wasn't informed by, because I did my undergrad and my PhD in the 1980s, 90s, and that was kind of pre the big attachment craze that has gone on. And so I've taken the insights from psychodynamic therapy, and I trained as a child therapist as well, and then I've blended them with Gordon Neufeld's attachment-based paradigm, because I just realized that was a piece that had been missing. The whole dimension of us as relational beings are continually formed through relationships. And it's not just that early developmental stage. It's actually from the cradle to the grave. And it transcends the grave, because attachments go on forever.
Yeah.
So I could give you a quick rundown of kind of what attachment-based counseling is in terms of even applied to grief, because that might help you understand the principles in a more applied place rather than just we talk about it theoretically.
Yeah, that would be great.
Would that be a good place to start? Okay.
Sure.
Okay. So I think the part that's the most relevant, so what's different about attachment-based counseling from sort of more clinical attachment categorization is clinical attachment theory is more of a diagnostic tool. And I don't think grief and loss are mental illness. I don't want to diagnose them, but I want to
understand. Amen. Sorry, I'm just going to pause that. Can you say that again? Because I hear the opposite so often.
Yeah, so there's nothing disordered about healthy and important grieving, because it's the flip side of loving well. Mm. Or having love stripped from us, or being separated from the one we want to pour our love in the direction of or receive love from. So the fact that love is at the core of our humanity, and when it's taken from us, we grieve, isn't actually disordered behaving or emotion. It's a really healthy response. Mm. I think attachment theory helps put it into a frame of health rather than disorder. But that's why I've stayed away from classical attachment theory, because it does seem to diagnose it and then put it into clinical categories. And when I found Gordon Neufeld's model, it seemed more organic. It seemed like it applied to the whole of life, not just to some of those early templates. And it made sense of my stories of grief, because my story is sort of saturated with tears from early abandonment at age 6, where that's where I started to get fascinated in attachment theory, because it started to make sense of where attachment ruptures had formed me mm-hmm. and deformed me. You know, being abandoned at age 6 by your caregivers in a boarding school means you ask some big questions. Did I not behave well enough? Why am I not being with my loved ones anymore? Was I too much of a burden? When will they come back? Am I lovable enough to be found again? Or is this me left forever? You know, those kind of questions came from that attachment rupture. And then I suffered an early loss of my parenting. My first daughter died when she was 13 months, and it made so much sense of the loss of one who you just start to invite into your life and you just start to form attachments with, and then it's severed. And then losing my mom when I was in my 30s, she died of colon cancer when she was 60. And then my dad just died, you know, 6 months ago. All of these losses have made sense through this attachment lens, because the deeper we love, the more we're going to feel the ripping of the fabric of our souls when we can't hold the one we love, or we can't gaze into their eyes, or we can't be what we would call in psychobabble co-regulated by our loved one. So if we're in distress, a hug is deeply therapeutic from the one we're attached mm-hmm. to. So that's why I stay further away from the clinical models of attachment and lean more into this organic attachment-based paradigm that Neufeld made. And then I've woven his material together with my 30 years of counseling and my neuropsychotherapy training to make sense of the parts of the brain that make us so deeply attachment beings, like the social engagement system, and why we get dysregulated when we're far away from a loved one and we can't find them or go to them when we're in distress for comfort and soothing. So those are the parts that I blend into this larger model of attachment-based counseling. Mm. So when it applies to grief, we've got the template of healthy attachment forms through 6 stages across the whole lifespan. But you can see it most prominently in early childhood. By stage 1 or level 1 is we attach through our senses. So being with our loved one, smelling them, hearing them, touching them, tasting them, kisses, snuggling them, all of those are big sensory ways of attaching. And that would be typical of an infant. Needs to be close to their caregivers for comfort. And as soon as they can't make eye contact or mommy moves away to put the laundry outside and baby wails in distress. And all the baby needs is mommy saying, I'm here, honey. I'm not too far away. And that's an attachment back to the senses. So baby doesn't feel the distress of abandonment because they're still connected sensorily. But by the second level of attachment, we can move to attaching through being like the one we're attaching to. So not just being with them with all of our senses, but now being the same as. So we try to copy them, or we try to find levels of connection with them. So a baby starts to learn how to walk and talk, and all of these copycat behaviors are part of their way of staying attached to their caregiver. Same in adult romantic relationships. We move from enjoying the presence of the other to, I wonder if we share many things in common. So we start to find out, you know, what hobbies do they have? Do they have a similar sense of humor? Do they like the same kind of movies? Do they like the latte, or do they prefer a black, you know, Americano? All of those pieces are part of attaching through sameness. Do we have enough in common that we can stay close to each other? And then by the third level, see, each of these you graduate from because you tick the box and say, yes, I feel attached to you in your presence. Now I want to be attached to you through being the same as you or similar ways of connecting. The third level is I now want to know, can I belong to you? And so belonging and loyalty is the third level of attachment. And to want to belong as an infant is I want to know who my family are and who strangers are so that I know who to run to in distress. And in Maori language, that would be, who is the whānau? Who is my kinship group? Who would I run to make sure that I can get help when I need it? Mm. And so that's where the stranger complex comes in for children. But in adult relationships, it's the sense of, can I belong to you as not just a random stranger, an acquaintance, but now can I start to be a little bit more connected? So would I not just move from a colleague now to maybe a friendship? Mm-hmm. And yep, you're my smaller hub of connection. And would you have my back? So that's the loyalty piece. If I get into trouble, who's got my back? Mm-hmm. And so we check that out even in the workspace. We check out, you know, if the boss is picking on us, did our colleague come and stand with us? Whoa, that was a really faithful colleague. I'll feel more attached to them than the one who walked past and rolled their eyes. Mm-hmm. Same with if we're a child in the playground, and our bigger brother comes and says, don't you dare mess with her. She's my little sister. Mm-hmm. You then know, I belong to this family and they'll be loyal. Mm-hmm. So the loyalty piece comes with the belonging piece. The fourth level is, now can I be special to you? So significance is level four. So we're not just random strangers and acquaintances. We belong, but we don't just belong in the outer circle. Can I start to belong special to you? So I'm not just one of your multiple children. Mommy, I want to know, did you miss me when I was gone? Did you think about me when you were at your work? You know, we want to know, is there more significance here than just one of a group? Mm-hmm. And that can also distinguish us from the friendship to the romance. Can I now be significant to you rather than just I belong in your hub of friends to, ooh, but maybe I could be the special one? Mm-hmm. Maybe we could have that romantic. This is level four now. Now, each of these levels create deeper and deeper vulnerable connection. Mm. They also create deeper and deeper capacity to be hurt.
Yeah,
that is the paradox. The deeper you're attached, the more capacity you are to grieve and wail and in a loss. Or if it's a betrayal trauma, then it's multiple levels of cuts.
And you cannot separate the two, right? And I think that a lot of times when we are, a lot of people pull away from real vulnerability, and that, you know, becoming significant to someone or allowing someone to become significant to them because we don't want to be hurt. And you cannot have one without the other. You can't be significant to someone without the running the risk that they will hurt you or you will hurt them.
Yeah. So the whole process of this is also gauging safety. Each time we pass a new level, we said they ticked the box. They looked like they could be faithful and loyal and have our back. They sound like they're safe to go to the next level. by level five, we now have even more emotional vulnerability because it's giving our hearts through love. So level five is, I don't just like you, I love you. Mm-hmm. Now that means we have such a strong emotional connection. If you tell me, no, actually, I just want to be friends, you know, return back to the acquaintance level because I don't really want this depth of stuff. Whoa, that's a wound. That's a huge back. That's a big rejection crisis because we were leaning into giving our hearts at this point. Mm-hmm. So if we've gotten to level five of attaching, we've now got emotional intimacy, mm-hmm. which primes us for the sixth and most sacred form of intimacy and the most vulnerable, which is, can I be known by you, uniquely known by you, even by my shameful secrets? Are you safe enough to hold the things I have never shared with anybody else? So that would be called psychological intimacy.
Okay.
You see me and you don't reject me. You love me, flaws and warts and all. Now I am fully yours. Six levels of me have landed.
Wow.
That's so if you have a loved one who you have gone to level six with, you have six layers of grieving to do. No wonder it's not a disorder. It's just a massive distress. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes complete sense. And I thank you so much for breaking it down in a way that is just so easily digestible because as you were talking, I was thinking, of course, about Jason and, you know, about like first you meet the guy and then he smells good and then you hold hands and then you start.
Jenna, did you know the sense of smell is the first way we fall in love?
Sorry, say that again.
The sense of smell is a huge part of falling in love, more so
I
than
believe
even what
that. I believe that because I'm a big like gotta smell good kind of thing.
Yeah. You're a big snuggler sniffer.
And so you go from, you know, that sensory layer into you laugh at each other's jokes, you know, and then there's you go into that sameness. Then of course there is the belonging, the loyalty, you know, I'm not just like every other girl to you. You're not like every other guy to me. There is, and then you move into the significance and it's just like the trajectory is really clear in the way that you said, because it takes quite a lot to come to that place of feeling that I love you and I want to be with you and no one else. And the emotional intimacy, which I think so many people really crave for, there's all those layers that people kind of jump into a straight, I don't know, kind of, I want to love you and I want you to love me, but, you know, let's push things through, especially because nowadays it's just so strange to create real connections that take time to develop. It's like, I'm going to go on a dating app. I'm going to, you know, just, yeah, have sex first. But when you do have the time to create those layers, to go, maybe not even create those layers, to allow those layers to unfold, then you get to the big one, which I, as you were talking, I had like, wow, this is so true to my experience. It's that whole real intimacy into me, you see. And then, of course, that person dies. And you're like, who's going to gaze into my eyes? I have no one to gaze into their eyes. I can't touch them. I can't smell them. I can't come home from a hard day at work and even have a fight with them because I'm safe enough to do so, or have a hug at the end of the day, you know? And it's all those layers. And I love what you said about if you have gone through all those layers, then you have all those layers to grieve as well, because it took you a long time to get that deep into loving and connecting with someone. And no wonder grief feels so complex, because by then you have all those layers. You're so deeply attached to this one human being that you're so invested into. And then what? You feel completely discombobulated. And it is like, I remember having this metaphor in my head of like this ruin, that my life became like a ruin. And not one brick could be layered on top of another. Everything was a big, big mess. I did not know how to start cleaning it up.
Yeah. And I like your analogy of the ruins. And I also, I went through a very different layer of loss with my own significant other through a betrayal trauma, but I experienced it as an earthquake had shattered my world, and I lived in rubble. And for the last 4 years, I have been sifting through that rubble to find out what parts of this rubble are still precious enough to make a mosaic out of, make something beautiful. Because it wasn't all horror, even though the 26 years was serial unfaithfulness the whole time that I didn't know about. So I need to separate out. There was joy. There was goodness. I had three beautiful daughters. We did life together that I had times of laughter. I've got to find those bits in the rubble. Because it's not all just take the bulldozer, scrape the ground clean, dump it somewhere in a big, huge pit, bury it and leave it. Because the attachment went so deep, you can't do that, or you dishonor your soul.
And I don't actually think it is even possible to do that, because I think that we end up trying to find ways to cope. But in the long run, we're not coping at all. We're just basically numbing it. We are trying to pretend it's not there. And sooner or later, there will be another earthquake, even if it's minor. And all that rubble that you try to bury is going to come to the surface
again.
It's going
to come again. And you and I lived in those shaky islands where, you know, the earthquake led to a huge amount of stuff just putrefying out of the soil again. And that's what will happen. And another analogy I often use with grief for clients is it's like tsunami after tsunami are going to come at you. So don't outrun the waves. Never turn your back to the waves. When you're standing in the cusp of a wave, the safest thing is deep breath, deep dive through. Only way out is through. If you start outrunning it, the wave catches your heels, and before you know it, you're face planted into sand and coughing and spluttering. And so, you know, it takes huge courage, though, to lean into the wave of grief coming at you and fully feel it.
Yeah, it's so true, because I remember thinking about that, thinking about the waves are too high all the time. I don't even have a time to catch my breath. And as the time passes, and I made decisions every single day that felt so, so confusing. Some days I'm like, I'm going to face this grief. And some days I'm like, I'm going to run away from it. And sometimes in the same day, I had so many conflicting emotions about how to deal with my own grief. But one of the things that I discovered very early on was that I was not going to take advice from people. And this was really different for me, because I have been my whole life the kind of person that I have a very strong sense of an inner knowing. However, I have been conditioned, and I think a lot of women can relate to this, to doubt myself and to doubt my intuition and to doubt my inner wisdom. And so I would be asking lots of people for their opinion. And I think I created this image of who I was as somebody that, yes, she's confident, but she's really open to other people's opinion because she is lovely and she's embracing and inclusive. And then people start telling me what to do and how to grieve. And that was when there was a lion inside of me that just went roaring out at people and going, no, I need to figure out how to deal with the tsunami on my own. And even if it bloody kills me, it's my grief. It's my waves. I need to learn how to dive into them. I'm the one, the only one that has to carry it. And it sucks. I don't like it, but it's mine. It's nobody else. And I think when I actually took possession of my own grief and decided that I was going to embrace it and face it, every time I came through one of those waves and I was able to catch a breath, I went, I didn't die. And then another one will come. And then I would go through again. And what that did for me was that I started creating a healthier sense of attachment to myself, yes, which I did not have before, because when Jason died, my attachment to him was so strong because of all those layers and many years of reinforcing those layers, that when he died, I felt like I couldn't trust myself. But it was by facing the grief every single day, sometimes several times a day, the tsunamis would come, the waves would come, that I started to find, hey, this girl that is so adamant that she's going to grieve her own way, I can trust her. And that was a really big thing for me, to reattach to myself.
Yeah. And in some ways, there's a beautiful story there of that as you're reattaching to self, because grief is deeply disorientating and it disorientates us from our true north. And in some ways, you mentioning you getting thrown off your deep intuitive knowing was the impact of grief too. It so disorientates us, we start to get unhinged from our core. We start to see the world as one of the pieces that's helpful about attachment theory is we come into the world asking two big questions. Am I lovable? And is the world safe? And when we lose our primary attachment, both of those two questions come in to being very unhinged. The one who I lost, will I be lovable again? And the world doesn't feel safe, because sometimes we lose them in such traumatic situation. We weren't prepared for this. There was no, like with your dear Jason, there was no warning. Mm-hmm. It was just a blindsiding of a sudden death. And I know, just because I was his counseling teacher,
one of his favorites, I must say. I think you're very up there with his favorites. You and Mr. McMillan is like up there.
That's very kind of you to say. But we all felt the winding, you know, we were all winded, and I just thought, well, this is us. We are holding Jason as his tutors and his teachers, but what is Tatiana going through right now? Her whole world has imploded with this sudden loss. So your world then becomes unsafe for a while, because you think, can I predict anything? Because that was my loved one who left cheerful and happy in the morning, and then boom, he never returned. This world trustworthy. So we get that level of disorientation on top of the tsunamis of grief. No wonder that has a destabilizing power over us. And so for us to then call that a pathology is very the one who's in pain, because it's actually just a really natural double layer of questioning. Am I lovable and is this world safe? Just brings us back to some primal attachment questions.
And yes, the world is not safe anymore, especially in the early stages of grief, but you continue to ask those questions. Like for me, it's been 3 years, 3 months, you know, and there are some days that I have got up and got ready and gone to work and not knowing how to face the day. And yet I face the day and I come home and I burst into tears, because I'm still kind of discombobulated. And a lot of people think that 1 year is going to be hard because it's all the first Christmas, first birthday, first Father's Day, and then you're going to be okay. And it's not like that at all, because the deep down, those questions are still there. Am I lovable? Am I ever going to be able to love somebody again? And for me right now, and this might change, but right now the question is no. And right now the question, am I lovable? The answer is no, because nobody knew me like nobody can know me like Jason knew me, you know? And so it's really hard to actually find an anchor for yourself. And with this, what I'm thinking about is like the whole attachment to self in a healthy way. Can we explore that a little bit more? How do we develop the sense of attachment to self when you feel like the grief and this discombobulating space that you are in makes you feel like you're losing your mind, that you can't trust yourself. Mm. How do we start regaining that or rebuilding that trust in yourself?
Yeah, and that's a multi-layered process, because a lot of it also comes down to what was our early attachment template from childhood? Because we get a first chance at being loved in our family of origin, and then we get a second chance at being loved in our adult attachments. Now, sometimes our adult attachments heal what didn't get taken care of in the first layer. And if we lose that safe attachment in adulthood, sometimes the wounds from the previous attachment stories come back and start to haunt us. Mm. Because you know, even as you were saying, no one will love me like Jason. Well, there's also a part where Jason knows you the most intimately. And so the day I was thinking, you know, the day where you used your one little thimble full of energy to get dressed, to have a shower, to have your coffee and get to work, and then you fall apart. He's the one who would say, there's my girl. She is so tenacious. Mm-hmm. Boy, she is so strong. She put the energy into her survival, and now she has permission to collapse. But wouldn't you prefer to be collapsing in his arms after a bad day, you know? So this is why grief continues to go on, because you actually, if you can engender at an imaginary level his delight at saying, there's my girl, you made it through another day, I'm so proud of you. Mm. Then we have that attachment in here forever. Nobody can take that from us. He's the one who knows how hard it was for me to even tie my shoes today, because snot was coming down my nose so fast, I was just about filling my socks. But he was there believing in me, because nobody believed in me like him. Mm. You know, so that's why we take our loved ones as an internal shield around our hearts. But there's the fact is, we're still made as very temporal, corporal, sensory beings, and we want not just the imaginary piece of the story. We want the whole story for comfort. We need the gaze for our mirror neurons to be recalibrated, to be calmed, to be soothed. So that's why grief sucks at so many levels, because we need level one, the senses, as well as the intimacy of level six, to be fully held. Now, if we didn't get loved well from childhood, we will have some core vulnerabilities when we have a grief and loss later in life too, because there will be some questions around, I guess that idea of, will anybody love me, or did I just get one chance to be loved? Because maybe the first chance I had wasn't very well and wasn't very good, and I don't know if I can trust love will come again. So that's one piece. But another piece is, can I even trust that my voice is being worth hearing in the world? Mm. Now, we can maybe go to our primary caregivers and we think, well, they didn't really attune to me and they didn't listen to me. But boy, Jason loved hearing my voice. Mm. And so that helps redeem a piece for us. And so we never fully create an attachment to ourselves just by being in a vacuum. It's always within a relational matrix. Mm-hmm. So the way our loved ones or our attachments reflect back to us what they see in us solidifies our sense of self. Mm-hmm. So the fact that Jason maybe was actually attracted to you because you were this feisty Brazilian who was fun-loving, that was goofy, that could give as good as she got, you know, that those parts were the parts that cemented up maybe a whole sense of identity in you of, yeah, that's me. I am that girl in this world. And then he'd be your
chief. Yeah, damn right.
So that might have been a different invitation than in previous attachments where some people misunderstood you, didn't get you, actually maybe felt threatened by your voice, so you had to go small in their presence, you know. So that's the part where the sense of self develops from infancy, but doesn't just stop there. It keeps growing and solidifying the healthier the attachments are. Mm-hmm. But if we've been pathologized in our grief, it's sometimes hard to validate all those parts. Like, yeah, I love the way you reclaimed your voice and reclaimed your intuitive wisdom to not take other people's advice, because that's them trying to colonize you. That's them trying to totalize your grief into maybe the only template they had of how to grieve. And you've got to walk your own journey. And your own journey is uniquely formed by the attachment template that you've created in your own life.
Yeah.
I maybe didn't answer your question very well.
Well, I don't know. I'm lost in what you're saying, because everything you're saying is so good that it doesn't matter if you answered the question or not.
If you got a wee nugget that was worth it, that's good.
Well, okay. So I want to ask you this, because I know that for me, one of the tendencies that was really strong, that I actually decided very adamantly that I was not going to give in to. I think too much. I think a lot. But this was like a very clear rational decision that I made, was that I was not going to canonize Jason. Because I've seen it time and time again. Somebody might have a very complex relationship with a loved one. That person passes away. And all of a sudden, the person who's left feels like the other person was great. They were a saint. They did everything right. And here I am. I'm the one that should have died, maybe. You know, might be a thought. I had that thought many times. I mean, I felt like it was so intense for me, because Jason was someone that was loved by everyone. I have never met anyone that would just, like, you know, turn their nose on him, like, because he was lovable and he was very genuine. He was very sure of who he was. He was very comfortable in his own skin. He owned himself and he made room for other people as themselves. And so people felt extremely comfortable and included in his presence. Then you take this guy that is a counselor in, you know, a very prestigious school. All the kids there, all the boys look up to him. All the staff looks up to him. All the people that we know together from our circles, you know, from Laidlaw College, look up to him. Everybody in our church looks up to him. And Jason is so giving. I, not as much. I like people, but to a certain degree. Very, you know, in certain times. I am not there all the time when somebody needs. Jason was there. I'm just very selective. How do I spend my energy and my time and my resources? And then Jason dies, and I start feeling like, oh my God, I was the crappy one in this relationship. I have nothing to offer the world. He was amazing. And now here I am. I should have died, because he would have carried on helping so many people. And who do I help? I can't even help myself. Hardly can help my kids. So I started really putting myself down and putting Jason in a higher pedestal. And I kind of, it took me a while, but I went, I need to snap out of this, because number one, this is bullshit. Number two, this Jason, you know, not everybody knew the Jason that I knew. And he was a human being with lots of flaws. And we had lots of intense fights about lots of things. And I had to start to reorientate myself to not make Jason somebody that was so incredible that I would feel like, now that I have this life that I'm still living, I can't do anything with it. So I think in that moment, for me, it was both a rational decision, but it came from my inner wisdom, my intuition of going, I am creating an attachment to a person that did not really exist. I'm magnifying all the really good things about him, and I am glossing over everything else that made him human. And this attachment is going to become very, very toxic, because it's going to put me in a place where I cannot lift myself out of this grief.
Wow.
So I don't think I'm the only one that does that, because I hear people talking about their loved ones as if they were Mother Teresa, you know?
Yes.
So I'm wondering, what do you think about this? Can we create unhealthy attachments with the person that died, because once they died, it doesn't mean the relationship, the love stops. The attachment doesn't die with them. The expressions of attachment have to change because they are not physically there. But how do we recognize that it's becoming a toxic attachment? How do we even start to get ourselves disentangled from that?
Yeah. Wow. And Tatiana, it sounds like you did such a profound natural healing process in that awakening of realizing I have pedestalized and canonized him. But guess what kind of thinking that is? That's actually you going into quite a bit of victim judgmental thinking rather than empowered and differentiated thinking. So we would often see this as part of a pathological pattern in grieving. If the other gets, they're all good, I'm all bad, if there's any splitting going on. So they were the saint, I deserve to die because I didn't contribute that much to this planet. That's actually, you know, if we were to ask the loved one who's passed, is that the truth? They'd say that's bullshit. They'd say, well, you complimented me beautifully. We were a wonderful team. And I wouldn't have shone as much as I shone if I didn't have you backing me. And you wouldn't shine as much as you shine. And, you know, so you seem to have moved to a true maturity that holds the black with the white, that holds the dark with the light, the shadow and the beauty. And that's a true mature love, which you said, you know, he wasn't all perfection. We had massive fights because we both, in our flawedness, came and clashed. And so to wake up to the realisticness of that also puts you in a much more healthier place to reclaim your sense of self in all of this. I'm not the shitty one. I am the one who was a complimentary, beautiful piece to his story, too. And we made a great team. And I deeply miss my teammate. But I can still contribute. Now, that's a grieving process that's quite far down the track, though, because at first, we may have to idealize him for a while when the grief is so raw. But when we start waking up to other layers and go, well, this has implications for some deep stuckness if this doesn't change. Because if they're all light, I'm all shadow. And that's not that's not living with mixed emotions. The mixed emotions is, yeah, he had some beauty and he had some flaws, just like I have beauty and I have flaws, and just like all humanity does. So that's a much more mature and balanced place to be. But if we do find we're starting to get stuck with that grieving, the whole part around, you asked, you know, could we, if that really continues beyond death, how can we even maintain that relationship even through these six levels of attachment? And this is where the remembering process is helpful to go back to, that in grief we may have to put back all the members or the parts of a whole that have fallen apart or become split. So the splitting process was all the light got pedestalized, but the dark was hidden. We might have to start re-gluing or remembering these pieces. And so some helpful ways of doing a remembering process is having some, like through the senses, having some rituals or going back over photos and things that you can touch and smell. And those voice, like even voice recordings of the last message he left. And these are ways of holding our loved one close. But we're also becoming quite realistic of when I heard that tone of voice in him, it would make me want to fight him sometimes. But that's the fullness of our love. You know, it wasn't just pristine and, you know, happy little angels dancing around. It was sometimes dark stuff coming up. And then the next level would be, what are the things we both like to do? And so we would, you'd remember the things that held you together through sameness. But you'd also remember the other part, which is, and we were so different on this other dimension. He loved this and I couldn't stand it. And, you know, and so you're creating a much more robust view of love than this very one-sided split version. when you get to level three of belonging and loyalty, there's a sense of remembering instances where he made me feel like he had my back. And if I ever needed anything, he'd be there for me. But you may have to go through some grieving over, and some memories came up where he actually sided with his mother. And that was not a fun Christmas. And boy, did I want to punch his lights out. And, you know, and that's okay for you to also, you know, bring another layer of the relationship up and grieve it and say, yeah, that's part of, we're flawed, but we were beautiful together too. Mm. And level four is, how was I made to feel significant and special to him? And you can remember the little touches he did, the things that nobody else would have thought, but his little love language that made you feel special. And then there would be, you know, that might lead to another layer of missing and wanting to have a conversation with him. And so that night, as you're going to bed, you just in your mind say, Jason, today I remembered when. And as you continue that conversation, it thickens your attachment with him. Mm. So the loved one, out of sight, out of mind, now we're creating layers and layers of staying close, mm-hmm. and having conversations, even about the unresolvedness. Mm-hmm. I wish you had really backed me up when your mother started picking on me. Mm. And then, you know, maybe even through this imaginary piece, and sometimes I even believe that whole spiritual piece, you may get a sense of him leaning in closer and feeling more connected. And you may even have a sense that he has some tears on that part too. Mm. So that your soul gets fed when you have these conversations, especially around unresolved bits. Mm-hmm. You know, to have it out with them is important rather than they have become saintly and they're untouchable. So we don't know what to do with the unresolved fights or the unresolved conversations that never really got finished. But level five is, how did I have a sense of being loved by them? And so when we're missing them deeply, recalling moments of deep emotional connection, and sometimes that can be evoked by a song, one of the songs that we love together, and you're pulled back into that slow dance, and you're pulled back into when he whispered in your ear, and you know, and that's okay, because I actually think our tears are our best gift. Mm. Embrace those tears. Embrace them because they're a way of saying his love was meaningful. Mm. So meaningful, rather than I never want to hear that song again, and we shut it down. Because we rip ourselves off of the depth of intimacy to stay connected by that song made me feel close to you again.
Yeah.
And then the sixth level is being known by the other. And so there may even be times when you get this sense of somebody misunderstands who you are, and you maybe had a fight with a friend. But then when you draw up an image of, wow, if I were to process this with Jason, he'd say, boy, they didn't get you, did they, hun? Mm. They didn't know you the way I did. And so, and I'm meaning, you know, you're having a fictitious conversation with him, but it's still trying to resolve something. And you get this wink from him that says, you and I know where that came from. And yeah, that was bullshit.
Yeah.
So there's a sense that they can still be healing us even now. Because the key thing is lean deeper into the attachment. Don't detach after death. And our culture is death phobic and tear phobic. And that's the biggest downfall we've had in Western culture. We actually need to befriend our tears. And we need to invite them daily if our grief is as huge as your grief is. And there's nothing pathological about that.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, you are a treasure. I'm just sitting here soaking in everything that you're saying. And there are so many, in every single one of those six layers that you just, once again, like unpacked so beautifully, I can think of both light and dark moments that I had with Jason, you know, just like, for example, he was, you know, in terms of love language, he was all about acts of service and he was all about words of, affirmation. So I would come home and the house was clean and the kids were bathed and, you know, and there was music, Brazilian music on. And the laundry was done. And he would be saying to me, "Did you see that I did the laundry, honey? Did you see that I cleaned the house? Did you see?" And instead of enjoying what he did, I got so annoyed because I'm like, I don't go around telling you when I clean the toilet. Like, clean the toilet. So what? You sit there too. These memories just start coming up. He did this beautiful.
But I beg to differ. I do think you had a saint then. If he was doing all of that. No, I'm teasing you. But that's how rich it is, isn't it? Because his love language was trying to come and take care of you. But your love language was also saying, "Hey, honey, there's something taken for granted here. I'm doing the loos every day and I'm not getting the accolades." And but that's how robust your love was.
Yeah. And it's just the how there were lots of things about him that I really loved. And depending on how the moon was, I really hated it. One of the things that I really love about what you said is this permission, not only to not be okay, not only to not petalize your own grief, but also it's a permission to use your imagination in your grief. Because there were moments when I felt really strange about talking to Jason, and people would ask me, "Do you talk to him still?" And I'd say no. But I did, but I felt weird doing it. And I really like when you talk about use your imagination to think about what he would say if he was here and you were having a really crappy day with your colleague at work. And it's giving permission to use my whole humanity in my grief. And I kind of go back and forth in thinking about, does grief needs recovery? Does it need healing? And I don't think so. But there are some times when I feel like I need to heal from something and I need to recover from something which the grief has unearthed. It's not that the grief itself is what I need recovery from, I need healing from. It's that the grief has opened up or cracked me open, and like what we're talking about, the earthquakes, you know, a bunch of putrid things are coming up. And so I need to clean that up. I need to heal from those deeper wounds that the grief has opened up. Yeah. But it makes so much more sense to me just listening to you right now, taking Jason in this journey with me, taking Jason as part of the Jason that I know, that I knew for 20 years, like, what would he say? Which also sometimes when people ask me, I was really angry at them, because if I'm about to make a decision, people would be like, "Well, what do you think Jason would say?" And they say it in a very patronizing way. And I remember snapping at someone one day and I'm like, "Well, fuck what Jason wants to say, because Jason is dead. The dead doesn't get to vote, so he doesn't get to tell me what to do." And in that moment, that again, it was just this fightiness of, I wanted to fight and go, "I'm going to figure this out on my own." But then, of course, I came home and I was crying because I'm like, "Okay, Jay, what would you say?" Because what he would say is really, really important to me still today. Yeah. And allowing myself to imagine based on those deep layers of attachment that I developed with him for such a long time in our marriage, I kind of knew what his answer would be really intuitively, you know, and allowing myself to use my imagination to unearth that, to go deeper into that. Mm. I think it's a really beautiful way of kind of facing your grief and embracing it in a way that your grief doesn't become your enemy, but it becomes not a destination, but part of this journey that you are in. It's the road. It's not where you should get.
Yeah. And I think the more we call it, it's a process rather than as it's a destination or it's a pathology to be healed, then we can normalize it, because in some ways, each person's grief journey is so uniquely marked by the attachment journey and the unresolved things from our early childhood too. So as you say, grief may be a catalyst. And I often see grief work as an invitation for growth work. You know, where's the invitation for growth here? Do I need to actually thicken my attachment to the one who's not here? Well, I even heard that in your response to when someone patronizingly said, what would Jason do? There's this very healthy, fuck what he would do. You know, I feel abandoned. He's not even here to consult. And that's a really healthy part too, because most of life is mixed emotions. It's not just raw sadness. It's sadness mixed with rage. How dare you abandon me? And our daughters are this young, and what the fuck am I supposed to do with the rest of our parenting? Because I'm not going to make it through, you know, and we can catastrophize and, you know, and I think that's us being more honest with our grief rather than we delude ourselves and think grief is one dimensional. I'll just feel sad. No, you're going to feel a whammy of mixed emotions that are so discombobulating and disorientating. Yeah. You don't even know which way is up at the end of the day. And you don't know if you're more pissed or you're more sad or you just couldn't give a fuck anymore because this is so emotionally draining. You just want to lie on the floor and be like a baby with a huge tantrum. And that's okay. And this, and to give deep permission for all of that to have space is, I think, a much more honoring way of saying grief is part of growth and grief is part of humanity. And there's nothing pathological about it. And it actually is way too complex to just be put in very neat little categorizations. And that's why I love the fact that, you know, Kubler-Ross's work has been so reworked because it was far too, that classical stages of grief was just far too clinical and far too defined and very linear. And I just love the meme that's going around now that you know, grief is just this chaotic squiggle of... Yeah. It's not a beautiful linear straight line where I've passed over from rage and now I'm nicely and serenely in sadness. And it's like, hell no, it's so not that.
It's not that at all. And some people can deal with certain quote unquote stages of grief, right? Number one, they think it is a very linear, chronological, sanitized way of grieving, and it's so not that. But then there is the bits that people kind of want to hurry you about, and so they are okay with your sadness and your vulnerability. They are not okay with your anger. But I remember a friend of mine saying to me, because I really lashed out, she asked me, well, basically, she said, here in my house, it had been a month that Jason died. And she said to me, look, you've been writing a whole lot of stuff on Facebook that is actually not okay. You need to stop that. You know, you need to grieve privately and you need to get your shit together because you got your two girls. You know, I'm just reminding you. I'm like, oh, thanks. I forgot I had two kids. and sitting on my sofa, like, I was just being like, I was biting everything she was saying. I had a remark right at the tip of my tongue. And I remember she saying to me, okay, I get it that you are on the angry stage. I was so pissed. And then that moment, there was something inside of me and goes, you have no idea how angry I am on my angry stage. This is angry stage on adrenaline right now. And then she opened her mouth to say to me, you just need to remember that Job... in the Bible, he lost everything, and yet he praised the Lord. And I said to her, well, Job can go and fuck himself, and you can go back to your house and go fuck your husband that's laying in your bed. And so I can go to my bed that has no husband in it and decide what I'm going to do with my life. Ain't nobody going to tell me how to grieve. Thank you very much. You can go.
Wow. Yes.
And so... I was on the grief stage in those 5 minutes, right? She left, clearly to say the friendship kind of, you know, didn't go forward. But I was in that angry stage for 5 minutes. And the moment she left, I was in that complete denial stage of going, I can't believe this. My husband is actually dead. I can't. And then the next moment, I was in this deep despair of feeling abandoned and feeling not only now, I was not just abandoned by Jason, I was also abandoned by a very close friend. And all those attachments that I created in my life were just falling apart. They were disintegrating because with the loss of Jason came the loss of so many other attachments. And it's discombobulated that it doesn't even start to express how I felt.
Yes, totally. And I think too, knowing that we may have some friends whose capacity to deal with the whole range of our emotions, their threshold is 1 inch, and we need people who have a mile wide threshold to cope with the whole tsunami of rage followed by despair. And it takes robust friends to follow us on this journey. And so you know, as you rightfully put some healthy boundaries around, that theology was not helpful for me. That was not an appropriate place. And I think there's a huge amount of pain that is inflicted by well-meaning people who actually haven't looked at their own minimal capacity to do the full threshold of life, which means our emotions are important, and the full range of emotions and their full expressivity is actually part of emotional maturity. If you can't handle what I'm going through, I may need to find somebody else who's more robust.
Yeah.
And that's putting boundaries around yourself.
I think that this is really important for people who are grieving, because until that particular conversation, which kind of was the catalyst for me to redefine and clarify boundaries around myself and my grief and my children, until then, I was in such a vulnerable state that I was basically, I was listening to some advice or what people were saying to me and their comforting platitudes that didn't comfort at all. And I was receiving them just like with a, you know, with a shy smile on my face and saying, thank you, because I didn't want to be abandoned by anybody else. I needed a community around me. And yet when that particular situation happened and that conversation happened, that was when for me, I had to really go, I need a community around me. Yes, that's true. But what is the quality of the community that I need around me?
So good. Yes. Because it needs to be emotionally safe.
Yeah.
If we know that there's some desperation around our need for attachment now, because we're in a massive attachment vacuum, don't just let any old attachment in. They must be emotionally safe. And so, as you say, grief is so discombobulating, even our radars can be off sometimes. So those moments of clarity where you just go, hell no, I am not taking that theological garbage on right now. There's the door. Please leave and close it from the other side. We're then also retaking some of the ground that grief is threatening to excavate under our feet, because we need to be surrounded by community now. But if we are in a toxic, say a faith community that's mostly talking victorious Christian living and has no space for lament, then honey, find a good church that can lament with you, because that space ain't got the capacity.
Yeah. And for me, there was, you know, I had to also redefine my attachment to God in the middle of all
huge.
Of that. Yeah. So reattachment, we talked about attachment to self, we talked about attachment to the person who you lost, then attachment to the community of people there around you. And then there is this other really, really vital part for my life, which was my faith and my relationship with God. And all of a sudden, God also felt really unsafe. And those two questions, you know, like, am I lovable and is the world safe? In relationship to God, my answer to both of them would be no. back then. Yeah. Now it has changed. But back then it was no, because if God really loved me, he would not allow me to go through all of this. And it took me lots of conversations with God, lots of conversations with myself to actually determine what is it that I need from this relationship with God, and who is God for me? Not the God that I've been taught about, you know, not the sanitized version of Jesus, but the real Christ that is with me in the middle of my mess with no judgment, that can handle. He can go not just a mile long, he can go just, you know, the whole world around 10 times with all my crap and still love me and be my safe place. But that took time, because reattaching to God had to, I had to detach from God, from my ideas of who I thought God was, to be able to have a healthier attachment to God. And now start to, little by little, find a new path in my spirituality.
That's huge though, isn't it? And I think, you know, there's a sense too where we're having to maybe, as you say, the detaching or the deconstructing of a theology that wasn't big enough for this crisis, and then reconstruct a more robust theology of who is God? Where, and especially those theodicy questions, where is God in a suffering world? Has he just turned his back? Does he really care? Is he a God who engages, or is he hands off? All of these are massive questions. And I think unless we've faced our own pain, we haven't maybe developed a theology that is congruent with our own experience. And so we have to throw out other people's theologies too, because that fit for their life. I've got to find one that fits for my life. And I know for me, I had, especially when my first daughter died and she was so multiply handicapped, I had such a fight with God. I was like, what the hell were you thinking? We prayed for her healing in the womb. We knew she was maybe compromised, but she came with a tiny deletion of her third chromosome, and every part of her body system was affected. So I then was like stretched to have very Pentecostal friends who were saying, but she can be healed. And I'm like, what part of this story do you not get? You know, she's, every chromosome is affected. Oh, God's big enough for that too. And I'm like, yeah, I believe that. But I also believe God deeply loves Bethany.
And just the Bethany, way Bethany is.
Yes. And Bethany holds the image, Imago Dei, the image of the Trinity. And our eyes maybe can't see it because we have another view of perfection, which is a child who's not blind and who doesn't have mental handicap and who can maybe feed herself one day, and who all of these things Bethany couldn't do. And she might be in a wheelchair all her life, and people would think that's a vegetative state and they would not see the image of God in her. But if you were attached to her the way I knew her, you would see the spark of divinity and nobody else did. And so why do you pray for that to be healed if actually that, she compared to my, I don't want to diss my other two daughters, but the only time Bethany cried was when she was in true pain. Whereas my other daughters used crying sometimes kind of manipulatively. And it was a bit like the purity of Bethany's soul could be seen, even though the packaging of her was riddled with brokenness. Mm. But at first I was so mad because so many dreams had died when Bethany was born. So I like to make a distinction with my clients. There's dying grief and there's living grief. There's death that is a finality. And then what does it mean to have birthed a handicapped child who may not outlive you? And so all of the reversal of human order, like we want to outlive our children. We don't want to be burying them first. We want our children to be able to do primary school and then graduate and get married. And so the death of dreams was huge. Every layer of dreams was dying. But we also wanted to return as missionaries to Brazil, and the sense of we can't take a fragile little one to the Amazon. She has to be plugged into a machine every night. And So the death of those dreams. So that's what I mean by living death. Mm-hmm. And then when she finally died, the grief changed to a final dying. But back to my rage with God, I was in a class with Eugene Peterson called The Spirituality of Everyday Life. And I was having such a wrestle with God because I just thought, you know, I think God's abandoned me. We had such noble dreams to serve him. Surely he wouldn't give us a handicapped child if he wanted us to. We were trying to be the best servants possible. This is a really, really shitty deal. Mm. And so I came into Eugene Peterson's class, and then I asked to meet with him privately, and I asked him, well, what does God want me to do now? He's kind of stolen my dreams, and I'm not okay with this. And Eugene Peterson just rocked quietly in his rocking chair for a long time. I thought maybe he didn't understand the question, or maybe, but he was in his deep contemplative mode. And then he said, Ruth, God doesn't want you to do anything. God just wants you to be. Just be your full self. And I'm like, oh, because I was very much from a doing culture, you know, and that's part of the workaholism of evangelicalism is just, you know, do for God and you'll be noble. And so this was paradigm shifting. Just be the mess that I am. Be this raging mother who wants to shout fuck it to heaven every day. And then he said, God can take your rage. Mm. And it was like, oh, wow. My parents couldn't take my rage. That was the most unholy emotion to have in our household. And so many of us have had attachment stories that have actually called us not to fully exist in their presence. You're not allowed to exist in my presence if you're ragey, angry, foul-mouthed, too demanding, you know. And many of us women get not invited to exist in this world in our fullness too. We're called aggressive when we're trying to be assertive. And so all those non-invitations that I got from my family of origin, I had put onto the face of God. And that wasn't the true attachment. The God that I was starting to now get to know was the God of sorrows and acquainted with grief. The one who buried their firstborn. Mm. The one who wept with me when I turned off her life support machine. The one who says, I've been there, honey. I know the searing pain of this loss. So those verses of, in all their distress, he too was distressed, were much more comforting than, oh, God's got a good plan for you. Don't you worry. He'll make something good out of this. And, you know, all things work together for good and all of that crappy theological misinterpretations were so not helpful. The ones that were helpful were, God can take your rage and he weeps with you. And there's no shame in your tears. Just bring them.
Yeah.
So those were the parts where I had to redefine a whole theological place for God to be safe enough.
Yeah. And I can so relate to so much of what you're saying. So much. Because I had to decide for myself, do I want to walk away from my spirituality? And I had, I really wrestled with that. And some days the answer was a very clear yes. Some days the answer was a very clear no. Most days the answer was really muddled. Mm-hmm. I just knew that the spirituality that I had up to that day was too small to hold the intensity of my grief and also to hold the immensity of who I was discovering that I am.
Yeah.
And I had to fit it into a box for so long. And, you know, you fit in, you find ways, and then all of a sudden a tsunami happens. And then guess what? There's no box that can fit you anymore.
Yeah.
And so I had to decide that for myself. And I think that a lot of people are really scared of deciding that because we've been taught a spirituality of fear. you know, if you really tell Jesus what you're thinking, then you're going to go to hell, or you're sinning and you need to repent. And I just go, oh my God, that is such a small Jesus. You know, it's just such a petty God, right? Mm. If I have to just behave to be accepted, then that's really a capricious God that I want nothing to do with. And then it was then.
And totally unsafe too. Yeah. If he's capricious, then I don't know if he's a trustworthy caregiver. So it's better to detach than to stay attached and be rewounded.
Yeah. And for me, it was really interesting that attaching to Jesus and to my own spiritual path in healthier ways required me to step away from the church. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's just being a really difficult ride. And it's being a ride that I am in that on my own. But I think
and it's terrifying, isn't it?
It is.
I've had to do it too. It's so terrifying because if church has been a huge village of attachment for us, no longer are we in a village. And when do we need a village more? When all the scaffolding of our life has been kicked away. And I found church wasn't safe. In my raw grief, church wasn't safe anymore. And I don't mean to vilify all of church, but some of the theology just wasn't big enough for the range of what I was going through. The tsunamis of rage, the deconstruction of the foundation stones of my life. And so I've had to, then I moved away from church and found just a tiny group of Christians who were also deconstructed by life crises. And we became a little safe space to belong. So I had to get rid of the big village and find a very select small village to wrestle and grow with. And we would be reading material that was way outside the box, but seemed to give voice to stuff that the church wasn't courageous enough to journey with us or didn't have capacity to. And so, yeah, that sense of you may have to be quite selective for a part of your journey to find a safe place to navigate a deconstruction, reconstruction journey.
Yeah, it's so true. Oh, Ruth, I can talk to you forever. And I know I have to let you go.
Tatiana, I was thinking how proud Jason would be of you in who you have become, running this podcast, recreating yourself, standing solidly on your Tatiana beauty. I think he would just be beaming with delight.
I know he would be. I know. You know, this week there was somebody that said to me, I am so sorry that you have to be facing all of this alone. I'm so sorry that you're going through all of this on your own. And the moment I heard that, there was a part of me that went, I'm not sorry. And that was a big revelation for me because I went, I am not sorry, because everything that I have been through right now and choosing to face it, you know, some days I felt like this grief was going to bloody kill me. And some days I felt like I was going to kill myself. I really did. Yeah. And I don't say that lightly. But just listening to that a couple of days ago, it was this incredible sense of going, I am not sorry, because the woman that I am becoming, I'm really liking her. Mm. And it has come at a huge price. If somebody had laid out the plan in front of me and go, do you want to buy into this? And I'm like, hell no. Hell no. I did not have a choice into Jason dying or not. What I did, though, have was the choice of how I was going to face this grief and do it every single day, because it's not you tick a box and you move to the next stage at all.
No.
Yeah.
You bravely have navigated it. And I've always adored you, but now I've got even more respect for you. So well done. You've done a beautiful job.
And I adore you too. And I'm so glad that we finally got to have this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, thank you for giving me this space.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Privileged.
Now, just in closing, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions that I ask everybody that comes on the show. And you don't need to answer them, okay? But the first question is, if today was your very last day on this earth, how would you like to spend it? Who would you see? Where would you go? What would you say to people, like, last day?
Last day. Wow. Okay, I think if it was just a 24-hour period, I'd seek to spend as much time with those whom I love. I'd thicken those bonds of attachment, because the severing of the bonds just through my passing would maybe be, I'm just away from them through the senses, but there are five other ways of holding on to me by being special to and sharing secrets and going deeper. And so, yeah, I would make sure that those bonds were thicker, so there was a legacy piece of, we've got lots to hold on to beyond the parting moment of no longer in this life. But I think the moral of the story there is, lean actually deeper and more intentionally into relationship. Don't detach when you anticipate a loss coming. And don't separate out, especially if you're afraid the vulnerability of the grief is going to be too much. Thicken and go deeper. So the more ways you have to hold on to your loved ones, the easier it's going to be for them to visualize and sense you close to them later when they go through these big tsunamis of grief. So yeah, just, I would thicken those attachments, and any of the ones that felt like they had been severed, I would try to reach back a bridge back over to say, I don't want this to be the last note in our symphony. So if it means a forgiveness or a I don't want to end here, I want the note to be a redemption one, then I would try to do that. I may not have enough time in 24 hours to do all of those redemption pieces, but that would be my hope.
That's wonderful. All right. So now a very last question. Say that you have one whole year to live, and this is your very last year on this earth. And what kind of legacy would you like to leave behind?
Wow. A year. Yep. That's a little longer. So we would have a bigger... I think the legacy piece would be, I might try to distill all of the things I've learned by working through healing attachments and working with counseling students. I'd try to maybe write a book, but I'd actually write it while I'm with my attachment people. So I'd be interviewing their stories and hearing more thickly how we've connected, so that we're kind of writing a story they can read beyond the grave to and stay connected to. So yeah, maybe there would be a bit of a legacy of something to carry on before just that little goodbye.
Well, I must say that I would be looking forward to read that book. So if you do decide, or when you do decide to write it, I would love to read it. And then you can come back on my podcast and we can talk about it, okay?
Yeah. Are you going to plop a little bit of slow-growing cyanide that says, okay, Ruth, the clock is ticking, 365 days, get that book written?
Well, there you go, Ruth. I'm not going to pop any cyanide, but I'm telling you right now, the clock is ticking, okay? And we do not know if we have today... We do not know if we have 365 days,
exactly.
But yeah, I am so full of gratitude for you. Thank you so much for your vulnerability, for your generous spirit, for sharing your wisdom, for sharing your heart. This has been an immense pleasure. Thank you.
Foi grande prazer. It was my deep pleasure too.
Oh, God bless. God bless you too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We have come to the end of our episode. And I want to acknowledge you, my darling, who have been listening to this conversation. Thank you so much for your time and your attention. Chances are you found crazy grief because you are grieving the death of your person, or you want to support someone who is grieving. I am so sorry our paths have crossed in this way, but I am glad we found each other. My email is on the show notes. Please reach out. I would love to hear from you. Do subscribe to this podcast and leave us a 5-star rating so we can continue to produce more meaningful conversations about grief. And remember, you're not going crazy. You're just grieving. Take a moment to breathe, reach out to someone you trust, and be kind to yourself. Light and peace.